Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is your co-host, Joe Hagan. I'm here with Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hi, I could barely stand it. I'm so excited for our guest that we have today. She's a woman who needs no introduction, but we're going to introduce her anyway. We're here with Bess Levin, who is a politics correspondent with us at The Hive. If you haven't read her, you've probably been asleep or under a rock or dead inside. Bess, hi. I'm so happy that you're here.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be here with both of you.
Yes, this is your world premiere on on our own Inside the Hive. You are Inside the Hive. Technically, you live there.
That's true.
And so it's long overdue that you're here, and we're so happy to have you here. And we're so happy to have you here on the subject that we will be addressing today, which is, broadly speaking, the Trump family. What the fuck? So that's sort of the broad thing. And within that, we have new reporting that we're bringing you. Emily Jane Fox has had some a peek inside the pages of the new Jared Kushner memoir. What's the name of that memoir?
Breaking History, which he certainly
and then
is.
There's more to that.
Yes.
There's a longer title.
There's a bunch of other words after that. And it's a 500-page book, I heard, so if you need to prop the door open, you can do that. If you don't want to read about his diplomatic genius, then you can at least keep your door open. So, you know, there's so much to talk about here because it's what's been coming out of this book in drips throughout the media are little revelations here. But, you know, they've also made pretty distinct, I would say, cameos in the January 6th committee with these sort of weird kind of ghoulish videos where they just look like these kind of millennial Ken and Barbie sort of situation. I can't really put my finger on what that is.
They've been disturbing.
And then, sadly, Ivana Trump just died in kind of this horrible way. She falls down some stairs and dies. And they bury her on a golf course, naturally. And the sons have all these bizarre things to say. So we're going to get into all this. But why don't we start just for a moment, Emily, why don't you bring us right up to the page on what it is that you learned getting into Jared's memoir?
Well, I did the job that no one else wanted to do. I have gotten a little sneak peek at Jared Kushner's forthcoming very long memoir. It is exactly what you would expect it to be. But I will say, you know, I've covered these people within an inch of their lives and have written basically every single thing that there is to write about them. And so it was kind of fascinating for me to see things that I've written about from a different perspective.
Yes.
With that said, this book is wacky. And the parts that I have seen outside of the other excerpts that other news outlets have run, and we can talk about those things too, have to do with the beginnings of his relationship with his wife, the beginnings of his relationship with his father-in-law, and some dealings in the White House, including interaction with Chris Christie, and the video with Ivanka Trump at the G20 with their world leaders that appeared to snub them.
Oh, wow. He goes in on that.
He does. So I'll start there because I was actually like, whoa. So he starts off this scene at the G20 with a phone call between his wife Ivanka and his father-in-law, then President Donald Trump. And he is saying to Ivanka on the phone, he being Donald Trump, saying to his daughter, "It's a real shame that I can't meet with Kim Jong-un when I'm over here in Asia for the G20. But there's this whole diplomatic process and you have to write him letters and the letters have to be flown in. Like, how the fuck am I going to get through to this guy? I've heard he follows my Twitter. I wish that I could just tweet at him. Do you think I should do that? I think I'm going to do that." And Ivanka says something like, "Well, that would certainly be your way, Dad." And so they hang up the phone and he does that. He tweets at him being like, "I'd love to meet you when I'm in South Korea tomorrow." And then Ivanka is allegedly asked by then Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who's now been assassinated, to speak at the G20 summit on issues of women empowerment. And Jared goes into what an honor that was for his wife and that all the world leaders opted to attend this summit held by Ivanka Trump. And then afterward, a 20-second video is posted by the French government that he says was totally out of context and that all those people in the video deeply respect his wife, but the media is out to get them and makes it seem like Christine Lagarde, who's the head of the IMF, is snubbing his wife and not interested in what she has to say, and that it was very painful for Ivanka. It really stung. And that as a husband, he wished that he could better make her feel like what she does matters, but that it was just another example of the media being out to get them. And I believe there was a quote at the end that was something like, "It really made us feel like the only things that matter to us were our faith, our family, and what we came here to Washington to do." So that was that one instance of the excerpt, which I found really fascinating because it's obviously like a different reality than the rest of the world lives. And I think that a peek into their different reality of a moment that we all witnessed for what it actually was a little fascinating into their psyches.
Yeah.
Jared and Ivanka have feelings too.
They do.
And even though their father and father-in-law is the world's greatest bully and a democracy-destroying monster, you should know that we sometimes get hurt. Our feelings get hurt behind the scenes.
If you cut them, they bleed.
Let me ask you something, Bess. I feel like my understanding of Jared and Ivanka as people is kind of opaque. I don't know if that's just how all of us are able, we can't really access who they are. Like, but if you had to kind of like describe to them in shorthand for me, like as a person who doesn't know them, who are these people? Like, I mean, Jared's the son of like a criminal, right? So he's pissed off about that. And that's
convicted criminal.
And he's got it out. There's a whole thing in Emily's report that's, I think, about Chris Christie and Jared's conflict in the White House. And we can get into that. But like, give me your sort of quick and dirty on these two.
I mean, I kind of assume there's not a lot going. Emily might know better. She's done more of the inside these people. But I assume there's not a lot going on below the surface. I kind of try to every now and then picture them in their home when they're just home together. And I don't think there's a lot of like depth that we're not seeing. Although I assume, you know, when they were in the White House, it was a lot of how dare these people? Can you believe this? But, you know, Jared is, I think, what we know he is. He grew up a very privileged kid. I call him the boy prince of New Jersey.
And as a Jersey girl yourself,
I feel like you have
authority when saying that.
Yes. Thank you. As you noted, Joe, the son of a well-known convicted criminal. One of my favorite Jared anecdotes was in a very old New York Magazine article from a long time ago. I think it was maybe 10 years ago.
I believe Gabe Sherman wrote this article.
Yes, I think Gabe Sherman wrote this. And it was about his father, Jared's father, Charlie Kushner. And it was, you know, for listeners who are unaware, Charlie Kushner, he was doing, I think it was campaign finance stuff that you're not supposed to do.
And all sorts of things.
And he found out that his brother-in-law was cooperating with with the feds. And so, I mean, this is...
I'll stop you there, Bess. Not only was he cooperating with the feds, but the district attorney who was taking on the case was none other than Chris Christie.
Yes. Right, exactly. This is almost... You can't find a person who thinks that Trump is a more evil tumor on, like, the pancreas that is America than me. But this, what he did, can you even imagine Trump doing this? So he sets up, to get back at this guy, he sets him up with a prostitute, sex worker, and he films the encounter, and then he sends it to his sister. And so anyway, to bring it back to Jared, I think this was a quote to, I guess, our friend Gabe, which was that he believed that Chris Christie was totally out of line for getting involved in this. And that it was basically that, you know, blackmail and other things of this nature are, I think in his words, family matters. So this is this sense of entitlement of who this person is. You know, did he ever hold a job that wasn't given to him by his father or father-in-law? No, I don't think so. And then, you know, we've got woman who works Ivanka Trump, and I think they're sort of made for each other. But again, I don't think Emily can correct me, but I don't think that, like, if we probe down deep inside, there's truly like another side to them that we're not seeing or that we're not giving them credit for.
Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
You hit a nail on the head in them being made for each other and the fact that both of their fathers are distinct in their own assholeness. And I think that I say this all the time, and I feel like I repeat myself a lot when I say this, but they have need holes from their father that are in the exact same spots. And their fathers are very similar in who they are and how they, not in how they raise their children, but in the damage that they inflicted on their children because of who they are. And I think that that is beyond their obvious privilege and the fact that they run their father's real estate empires in New Jersey and New York, and they went to the same kind of schools and their relationship was mutually beneficial. They are just damaged in the exact same way in the exact same spot, and they're able to really relate on that. I think that they love each other, and that's very clear in both all of my reporting and this book. And I think that what's fascinating to me in this book is years ago, when I was reporting on my book about them, I had someone send me emails. It was like someone who dated Jared in college and in their early 20s. And she sent me emails between the two of them that I never published because I felt weird about it. And also it didn't add anything, but this book reminded me of it. And the emails were like so lame in what they suggested to do. Like, he was naming his perfect Sunday, and it was like, I want to do yoga and sip coffee and read the New York Times in full in print. And I was like, these are the emails you're like sending your like long distance girl. It was like so
right
lame to me. But this book in the details of him dating Ivanka in the early years had that same vibe to them. Like, they went to lunch as their first date in their early courtship. He was so excited to walk around New York with her and see areas of New York that Ivanka Trump had never seen because he was scouting for development.
Right. And wow. That's romantic.
On Sunday mornings, very. Nothing says romantic like gentrification. And they would go on Sunday mornings to local restaurants and bring their backgammon set and the New York Times and sip coffee. And that was their early courtship. And it seems ick to people who have a sense of irony, right? And particularly to describe your early courtship that way. But I think that they're just, that's the level of depth and surface right. and irony that they have. So I think, right. I think you're right. Of course, when you get home and take your bra off and turn the lights off, you see a different side of people. And I obviously have not been privy to that side, but I think that the side that they show most people is this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they both seem, you know, they're so kind of put together and refined in all the ways that their parents aren't. As if they are sort of like iterative marketing tools for all the terrible things about their parents. Do you know what I mean? It's a sort of a strange thing to say, but they seem like kind of constructed, you know, and mm-hmm. they don't have that, the lack of depth, the sort of surfaceness of it is almost like the point of how they want to present, right? And not be seen as like crude monsters.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I was writing this book, I thought about this a lot and I talked to some therapists and they explained to me that narcissists see their children as mirrors. So they want their children to reflect all of the qualities that they believe about themselves, even though those qualities aren't true. So oftentimes, sensitive children of narcissists will go out of their way to be the mirrors that their fathers or parents want to have reflected back to them. And I think that that's what you see in the Trump children.
Do you think that's why Trump hates Don Jr. so much because he's not reflecting back what he wants to see in himself?
I think that there are things that he really likes about Don Jr., that he, yeah. the ability to rile up a crowd, to really speak to this base of people, I think that that really speaks to him. But I think that a lot of the other stuff does not speak to him and does not reflect the mirror back that he wants to see.
Yeah.
Bess, I'm so curious because you have covered every single day of the Trump administration, the happenings, the characters, that has included the Trump children, that has included the president, that has included sort of anyone who's in the news at this moment. The evolution of the brand Trump, the name Trump, the kind of the chaos around him, it has evolved and both has not evolved at the mm-hmm. same time. And we're now seeing him hosting the Saudi golf tournament in Bedminster and burying his ex-wife at the course, as some have noted, that would give them a tax break because if you use non-cemetery land to bury someone, you get a tax break on that. So I'm curious, as we head into 2024 territory, where in your mind the Trump brand stands and what has changed in your covering of this brand?
Look, we didn't all know, but a lot of us, I would hope that we could say the people who work for the Hive and et cetera knew that he certainly should not have been elected president. That was going to be a terrible, terrible thing for the country. And that, no, he wasn't just this sort of harmless carnival barker idiot. But clearly, after the last, you know, four years in office and then however long it's been since then, I think it's been a year and a half, it's gotten so much darker, I think, obviously, because he incited an insurrection and almost got his VP killed. And, you know, we're hearing his plans for the second term. Axios had that big investigative story about how, you know, he's going to purge the administrative state of tens of thousands of civil servants and just install loyalists. And so, you know, obviously, a friend and I joke that sometimes he does stuff that obviously is unintentionally, but like he's just, sometimes you want to just be able to laugh at his stupidity, but like, and it would be great if he wasn't president and didn't have any power. Like that sure. would he did and he wants more. And so it's just so much darker now. And it's so much scarier. Like I'm married to a person who is British, and I don't wanna be a liberal cliche, but I've said, if this guy is president again, I am out of here. I can't be in this country. And, you know, you can check back in and maybe I'll still be living in New York. But it's just it's so much scarier. It's not just it's him throwing paper towel rolls into the crowd in the devastated Puerto Rico, which obviously was awful. And it's not just these, he sharpied over a map to say, actually, the hurricane was going to hit this place. It feels full on authoritarian, just darkness. And it's very scary.
It's so interesting to hear. I mean, you also, because you cover these things every day, have such an encyclopedic knowledge of the absolute horror show that we all lived through. And so I could hear you talk about all the things that I've blocked out of my brain for a very long time. But you write about these things with humor, and you have such an incredible wit. And that's why I think what you read is so intensely popular and such a joy to read. But it must be very difficult to find the humor. You know, it's funny to read. In some ways, it's eye-rolly funny to read about the map of the hurricane storm or that moment in Puerto Rico, but it's not really funny to read about an insurrection, but you still find the humor in it. And the process of that must be fascinating.
Yeah, I just, I really try to, again, I know I was just talking about the darkness and how I need to flee the country, et cetera, but I can't go to that place every day. Because I would just never be able to get out of bed. So I try to look at it while not at all sort of clearly not sugarcoating it, but just try to look at it from the surreal angle and hope that there is some like catharsis that I can bring to people who are also going through this nightmare and just feel like so they can feel like they're reading this and they're not alone and just wanting to like scream into a pillow every day.
If you didn't laugh, you'd cry kind of situation. And
sure.
But at the same time, the way that your humor works, by the way, is that there's a sort of cold fury in some of the humor. Like you're like, you just can't believe how horrible this is. But, and one of the things you wrote about recently, to bring it back to Jared Kushner for a minute, his relationship to the Saudi kingdom and the $2 billion that he took and his rationalization of kind of overlooking this murder and saying, oh, well, it's good for women over there.
Right,
when I read that, I was just like, oh, my God, you were just a terrible person. But you say, you know, Kushner pinky swears that, you know, his investment had nothing to do with the fact that he treated the Saudi prince and, you know, so nicely while working for the U.S. government, right? Draw us a little further into that particular little side of the story, because that's where a book like Kushner's is really about. I'm going to spin every single thing I can, and you have to kind of like counterspin it and stop the plates from spinning to see what's actually going on.
Right. So just the quick catch up for those who were able to block this out of their minds.
Lucky you.
Jared Kushner. Yes. He pretty early on, I believe, in the Trump administration, he decided he was going to cultivate this friendship with the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who is the de facto leader. His father is still around, but he is the ruler of the country. And there was all these reports about, you know, they were WhatsApping and just, it's, you know, two guys just bonding. And I think Jared, his idea was that the prince was crucial to his big vision for the Middle East, because, you know, Jared in his mind solved peace in the Middle East. And so when the prince, according to our intelligence agencies, ordered a hit squad to kidnap and dismember via bone saw Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident, also U.S. resident, who worked for the Washington Post. We know that. So even before Jared's book, there was just one of my favorite New York Times articles was talking about how Jared was really going to bat for him inside the White House, and how he, I think, told Trump that the prince could weather this criticism, just as he had, weathered past criticisms of human rights abuses, et cetera. And it, his belief that this was all going to blow over, which was just so amazing. Because, again, this man was chopped up into little pieces by a bonesaw. And ultimately, I don't know if Trump needed convincing, because he had his own reasons for wanting to not crack down and not condemn this. But basically, the guy completely got away with it. Nothing happened. And then in Jared's book, this excerpt that just came out last week, he talked about the situation, and he had an amazing line where I think it was, while this was terrible, and then it was, you know, I wasn't willing to overlook all the positive reforms that he had made for the country. He let women drive, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you never want to start a line about somebody being kidnapped and murdered and chopped into small pieces by saying, well, this was terrible. And it just, it was amazing to me that that's his spin. And then again, for the readers who aren't necessarily aware, not long after leaving the Trump administration, Jared raised $2 billion from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. And you could look at that and say, wow, that seems kind of coincidental.
Well, he had his phone
number.
You know, he had his phone number. He could WhatsApp him. Hey, you got 2B?
Sure. But the best part of it was that, as the New York Times reported, the due diligence panel for the people writing checks said, absolutely do not invest with this guy. He has no idea what he's doing. They don't have an investment thesis. They basically don't have any employees working for them. There were like just pages and pages of reasons not to give Jared Kushner money that were told to the Saudi Wealth Fund by the people they employed to tell them these things. And it was overridden by a friend in a high place in Saudi Arabia.
Gee.
But Jared says, you know, one had nothing to do with the other.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
There's another little piece of the reporting that came out was his conflict with Steve Bannon, right? Because they were at odds inside the White House, and Bannon says, I'm going to break you in half, which is just like hilarious because he's like Jabba the Hutt versus the little weenie, kid. But it's just all cartoonish and ridiculous. But after all of this conflict, he sees that Bannon is in legal jeopardy over raising money off the wall.
It would GoFundMe for the wall. Yeah,
this is unbelievable. And then this line really just stuck out at me, and I was just like, I actually wrote a little note, what, next to it, because he says, even though he had played dirty and dragged me into the mud of the Russia investigation, but now that he was in trouble, I felt like helping him was the right thing to do, Kushner writes. That's it. That's the entire explanation. He basically imbues himself with a Christ-like forgiveness for having just gotten, for a guy that threatened to break him in half and to ruin him in the White House. He's like, but I felt like it was the right thing to do. Oh my God. Well, it's anyway, one of the things
he's a saint. Yeah. Truly.
It's fascinating that the excerpt that the Wall Street Journal ran about his relationship with MBS in Saudi Arabia goes into the fact that Jared gave that explanation that you explained best, that he has done such good for Saudi Arabia, and when it, particularly right. when it comes to women in the country, that despite him chopping up a U.S. journalist, he's done so much good. And so sometimes you just have to weigh the good and the bad is basically right, what he was saying. Yeah. And the good there overrides the bad. And then the Wall Street Journal rightly notes that U.S. intelligence came to realize that it was, in fact, MBS. And sure, that it was
his denials. Decided,
despite yeah. his denials. But there is no acknowledgement of that in the
book. No. Jared, I appreciate that they said he doesn't refute it because he doesn't even mention it.
He doesn't even mention it, yeah. which I think yeah. is a very deft way of handling that. And I think that kind of tells you everything that you need to know. But it goes back to what we were talking about in terms of them having their relationship with their parents and their damage from their fathers. And I have always said this about Ivanka, and I believe it to be true about Jared. They are master compartmentalizers. Yes. And Ivanka actually once told me, because I use that to describe her a lot in my writing, she was like, "You always describe me that way, and I think that that's true."
Oh.
And I was like, okay, this
self-awareness.
I truly.
Fact-checking. Confirmation. I think
a lot of children who have come from parents like that and family situations like that have to be, that they're able to separate different parts of themselves and different parts of their relationships with these people in order to be around them. And so I think that because they are these master compartmentalizers who are used to parsing out different things about their fathers and their families, that like these things are bad, so I'm going to forget about them so that I can take advantage of the good or be around the good. I think that they are, you see that at play in the White House and in their relationships around the world. And if you understand the psychology, you and I and a lot of people listening to this don't have that ability because we've never had to do that. And so we see bad people as bad people, but they see bad characteristics of bad people and take those out and accept whatever good that they can find in them because it serves them. So that's sort of the lens through which they see the world.
Yeah. And there's a kind of like, you know, real politic explanation for it. I mean, back to Kissinger, sure. right? Kissinger made all kinds of deals and with nasty, horrible people in order to achieve different ends. So the question becomes, did Jared solve the Middle East peace problem? And so,
Bess, I'm going to put that to you.
Oh gosh. I mean, I think he believes he has. And yeah, I mean, it seems like ship shape. Check that off. It's all done. My favorite analysis of Jared's peace plan, because he did the economic part first, was this is the Monty Python sketch of Middle East peace initiatives. And look,
perfect.
I think Jared is such a great guy, and I would never want to suggest that he didn't achieve what people have worked for decades and decades to do. So let's just say, yeah, he solved it.
I mean, I actually don't. This is an area in which I have to claim ignorance about what it is that he was trying to do.
I think one of the things that people have said about his plan was that he really just believes that the situation in the Middle East and, you know, the situation with Israel, et cetera, is just, he just views it as like a real estate situation and like a real estate deal. And so he just thinks like, if you can put some money here and move some things around there. And then I think he famously said that they just need to stop, quote, doing terrorism. And then the problem is solved. So I just don't think he necessarily has the understanding of the situation there. But Emily,
feels right. I think sentient people know that there's not peace in the Middle East, thanks to Jared Kushner. But if you talk to people who are around him, they believe that he has made great strides.
Yes.
And perception is reality to a lot of these people who have then decided to give him money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he talks about it in such a way, and his father-in-law, who's a master brander, has talked about his accomplishments in such a way that people around him believe it and have enough faith in him because of that branding that they are willing to give him a lot of money for a fund that is also populated by money from the Middle East. And
yes.
I don't think that there's a coincidence there. And I think that for his purposes, it has worked. It doesn't matter if there's actual peace in the Middle East. It doesn't matter if actual progress was made or not. It it matters that it has led to him being able to raise this fund that will make a very rich man even richer for the rest of his life.
Yes, I think all these people, you know, it's the famous, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Yes.
They say it enough times, it's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and it gets back to the larger idea of the Trumps as this branding machine. And, you know, we create reality by creating an entertainment product that bludgeons mm-hmm. you into believing it's true by making it so sticky and attractive that you, I mean, that's how the media got addicted to Trump. We're all implicated in that. And how the people who are into Trump, you know, the Trump believers, you know, they're addicted to this personal relationship that they have developed with this brand, you know?
Yes.
And it has to do with entertainment, has to do with being stimulated on their internet sites and the social conspiracy theories and feeling like they're empowered to know things that the mainstream media doesn't. And that's the whole underground tunnel to Trumpism, right? Which brings me back to this, what I found that I just was reading about Ivana Trump's funeral at the golf course. And if you couldn't make this up as a scene in a movie. I mean, it really is. The whole family has come together on the golf course to put the gold-hued coffin into the ground. There's a poster board, by the way, of Ivana Trump on the cover of Vanity Fair magazine in 1992 with the headline, Ivana Be a Star. Right.
Yeah.
This is like, here we are. We have arrived at this completely surreal Trump moment where all the brand values have come together in one place. Talk about this, what you guys have observed about this whole thing.
Well, I don't know if we were talking about this earlier, if we mentioned at the top of the show, but it was, you heard about the eulogies. So, Donald Trump Jr. gave a speech about how recounting a time when he, I guess, acted inappropriately at a restaurant, and she took him aside and basically, it sounds like, beat him with an inch of his life, and he was so proud to tell this
with a wooden
story.
Spoon. Was that the wooden spoon one?
I don't actually remember if that was the wooden spoon story, because I think that might have been a different one, because where would she get this wooden spoon? I guess maybe she could take it from the kitchen.
No. I don't remember, but it was all about corporal punishment. Ivana being kind of Eastern European style iron fist on the kids. Yeah.
All about corporal punishment. And then I'm not sure who it was. I don't know if it was a former housekeeper, but she then started talking about, you know, the parasites who had descended upon her in her later years.
It was Dorothy, their longtime nanny who looked after their children for many, many years. That one of the things that stuck out to me was in Ivanka's eulogy, she said that her mother reacted when she told her that she was converting to Judaism to marry Jared, that she must really love him if she was willing to give up lobster, which I think is a very funny line. And in the excerpt that I read from Jared's book, he talks about the conversation in which he told Trump that he was converting. And Trump basically said, well, why aren't you converting? And Jared's like, that's a good question, but this is what your daughter decided independently. And he said, okay, well, I love the Jews. People always think I'm Jewish anyway. All my friends are Jewish. The synagogues love me. They always give me their awards. And he basically said, but you better, you know, Ivanka's in the prime of her life and Tom Brady wants to go out with her. And Jared says that he joked she should go out with Tom Brady, and Trump deadpanned, I know. And that was his interaction.
He frequently returns to the Tom Brady, the fantasy that they were going to. I think, you know, in the last few years, they've been married for 10 years, and he's still talking about how she could have dated Tom Brady.
Oh, I get it. I probably would never stop talking about that either.
Yeah.
I would continue on with that forever.
But yes, Trump, huge, so big with the Jews. He loves them. He's got so many. He's got Jewish grandchildren. That's true.
Now, I just want to say that the report about the funeral in the New York Times was written by Jacob Bernstein, you know, son of Nora
beautifully
Ephron.
Beautifully done. Yeah.
Beautifully done. Son of Nora Ephron and Carl Bernstein. And he describes the kicker to it was really great. You know, that the casket, after they said their words, was going over to the golf course at Bedminster, where the ground was consecrated so that she could have a traditional Catholic burial. And then this is the kicker. It was, in a way, the former couple's final joint real estate deal.
Beautiful.
Which is just kind of a beautiful bit of poetry there. And back to the real estate thing, which we keep bringing up because these are the scions of real estate guys. They treat the Middle East like a real estate deal. It's like we're living in this real estate reality TV show,
right?
That won't seem to go away.
When I heard that she was being buried there, like, is she the first person to be buried at this golf course? Have they buried people there before? Is it
not
off-putting to people playing golf there that there's a bot? I have so many questions. And I saw that same thing on Twitter about how, you know, he probably got all kinds of tax breaks for this. And that sounds right. But then I would be surprised that he hasn't buried people there before.
I think he's prepping it for himself, too. Isn't that true?
there were 10 plots. I read this somewhere that there were 10 plots set aside for those close to him, that there is a tax break situation allowed in this instance. I think it's have you ever been to Bedminster? I'm sure you have as a New Jersey person. You've been by there.
Yes, it's okay. Horse country. Yeah.
It's horse country. It's quite sprawling. I don't know that it's like in the middle of the golf course, though. That would be something. But there's a lot of land there.
I would imagine
it's like, yes, exactly. I would imagine it's sort of off the beaten path, but who knows? I don't know. Maybe it becomes a destination.
It's near the clubhouse, I read. And but you can't get to it unless you have like, you know, a VIP pass. You know,
right?
And that's a special VIP pass to get into Trump. I'm sure they'll charge. You know,
it was a small. I saw a photo. It was a small headstone. I was surprised that it wasn't more Trump-like,
gold-plated.
But maybe.
Well, she's the ex-wife.
That's true.
Right.
His current wife still has to live there.
That's true.
So I'm sure it has to be small as possible in order to get away with it. As we head into this new era of possibly Trump, possibly not Trump, who are the people that you're having the most fun writing about?
Oh, God. I mean, fun?
Who are you enjoying?
I don't know if fun's the word. I'm writing a lot about Ron DeSantis these days because, if possible, he's worse than Trump.
How?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's in the way that everyone has always said, which is that if Trump were actually competent, he could have gotten a lot worse things done. And so I think that DeSantis is definitely more competent than him, because most people are. There was that great New Yorker article about him. I think it came out a couple months ago.
And yeah, the Dexter Filkins profile, yeah.
Yes, and they talked to you know, a bunch of people he played baseball with in college, and yes, people can change since college. But having said that, I think one of the quotes was just about how he lives to humiliate people, and there's no one is a bigger dick than him, and that kind of seems like how he governs. He punishes people who don't agree with him. Disney. I think he recently sued over the drag brunch. So, yeah. And if it's not Trump, I think he has a very good chance. So that's scary. I haven't really answered your question of who
Can I chime in there just about DeSantis for a minute?
Yes.
We hear a lot about him. We hear his name constantly. And obviously he's got political potency in Florida. But what we haven't seen is really seen him out on the national stage in a way that has been defining yet, right?
That's true. There's
so much talk about him as this nascent guy. And how many times has this happened in previous election cycles where they talk for months about a character? Then he appears on stage for the first time and everybody's like immediately underwhelmed, or they fall on their face immediately. And it's like, oh, this is what we've been raving about for the last year. He strikes me as somebody that could fall into that department. And I'll tell you why.
Yes, and there's so much time.
Yeah, there's so much time, and he has to have a defining personality that people want are attracted to. They can't just like him simply as a assholic bludgeon to go after their enemies, although, because Trump had more than that, right? Trump was an asshole, but Trump was entertaining and he gave them something, right? Mm-hmm. Does he have that kind of like a song and dance, you know, top hat and cane kind of vibe to him, which I don't think he does. I'm just going to put that out there as like, let's plant that seed and maybe I'll seem like a genius a year from now. But I just want you to take that into consideration.
No, I fully agree with you. And I think how far out are we now? I mean, I know people start running now like 5 years before the election, but there's so much time for him to just flame out. And that would be great. But, you know, Emily, to answer your question, I really will always have a soft spot for writing about Jared Kushner. Specifically him, not more than even Ivanka, because there's just something about him.
Well, I have news for you. I don't think they're going around anywhere. So you have plenty of content, and you will have to keep them honest and give us your take on all of the foibles. I think that this book will give you a lot of material. The book doesn't come out until the end of August, so you have weeks of excerpts coming out for you to chew on and have fun with, and we can't wait to read it. And we're just so grateful to finally get you here and to hear your beautiful wisdom on Inside the Hive.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was delightful.
We will be back again in a couple of weeks, because we are going to be having some special episodes in August to review some of our greatest hits of the last couple of years. So stay tuned for that. And soon enough, we'll be at Memorial Day and pivoting into the fall. And God knows what will befall us then. But we will be here to document and opine and cry about it. And laugh.
That's great.
And laugh.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.